trying to address is how can we get from loop quantum gravity as a quantum theory for natural and gravitational degrees of freedom in the background independent way? How can we obtain something as quantum field theory on fixed space time out of that? And this is work which I done together with Thomas Thiemann and Christina Giesel, and it's about to be published, so that we can put the article online in the next few days. So the outline of the talk is the following. So first, I want to state the problem and want to tell you what is it exactly what I'm doing. And I want to tell you a bit about previous work which has been done in that direction, and point out where, at least in my point of view, the open problems are. So which problems have been addressed, and then I will tell you a bit about reduced space test quantization and quantization in a preferred material reference frame, which leads to a certain physical Hamiltonian in a gauge fixed way, which is an important step which was missing in work carried out so far. And then the main point of my talk will be I will talk about Born Oppenheimer methods, which is a certain method how to get if you have two sets of variables and you want to treat both in a quantum way, and then it should be possible to treat only one set of variables in a quantum way, the other one classical, and this is the method which you can use for that. And if time allows, but I'm not really sure, then I will talk about a certain toy model or a different representation for a gravitational field algebra, which can be used to exactly do that, what I was telling you, but otherwise I will state the results and explain why this one on a simulation can be used for doing that. Okay, so let me first state what the problem exactly is. When we look at loop quantum gravity on the one hand side,
bigger fonts, please.
Okay, when we look at loop quantum gravity at the one hand side, yeah, and quantum field theory on the other hand side, then they look quite different. When you allow me to sketch the mathematics of the two frameworks, then in loop quantum gravity, we have the Hilbert space, which is the Ashtekar-Eichner-Minkowski Hilbert space, which is the space of square integral functions of a certain set of generalized connections. And elements of this Hilbert space are the so-called spin network functions. And these are basically functions of living on certain embedded graphs, which are labeled by representations, irreducible representations of SU2. And spin network functions are just functions from these constructs into the complex numbers. And then I need to tell you how do the basic geometric operators of general relativity act on such functions. And we have the holonomies, which are basically the connections integrated along one-dimensional axes. The holonomies, and the holonomies in this picture, they act as multiplication operators. And the second thing which we need to know is we have fluxes, and the fluxes, they carry the information about the geometry of the three surfaces. And the fluxes are basically densitized triads integrated along two-dimensional surfaces embedded in the three-dimensional surfaces. And these flux operators turn out to be vector fields, and thus are derivative operators on these cylindrical, on the spin network functions or cylindrical functions. And one thing which is very important is that the commutator of two flux vector fields is not zero, as we expect. So in this sense, it's not really easy to see how a classical geometry, which of course has a commuting three-dimensional matrix, should emerge out of this picture. This is already one point which is a bit complicated. But more, so this is a kinematic setup, then I need to tell you what is dynamics, and this question is so far not really answered, but we have a canonical Hamiltonian. In the classical theory, this canonical Hamiltonian must be zero, because it's only a sum of a constraint, and in order to extract the true physical degrees of freedom in the quantum theory, we should impose this canonical Hamiltonian as an operator acting on, let's say, the spin network functions, and this must be zero. So on the other hand, we are we have ordinary quantum field theory on, let's say, a curved background spacetime. And for quantum field theory, the very important ingredient is we have a four-dimensional manifold M, and this manifold carries a metric structure G. And this metric structure G is very important when we write down the in the whole formulation of the theory, because when we have a Hamiltonian operator, this is a non-vanishing operator, and this generates dynamics for quantum fields. If we just use the example of scalar field theory, then we have scalar field operators and their conjugate momenta, and we have a classical metric G. And then what one usually does is one constructs a Fock space, which is the best thing to do if one has an interpretation of in terms of particles in mind. And in order to do that, one constructs cremation and annihilation operators, which are just functions of the fields and their momenta and of the classical metric. And this transformation knows about the Hamiltonian and it knows about the metric. This is important. And then we can define what is the state space of the theory. And the state space is just a Fock space. And this Fock space has a vacuum vector zero, which depends on the metric again. And this vacuum vector is defined by the condition that it gets annihilated by all the annihilation operators. So this is basically the structure of an ordinary quantum field theory, at least of a free quantum field theory.
For to do this, there are conditions on the metric such that there'd be timelike global timelike Killing fields. Do you impose?
Sure. There are of course these conditions. On this side, I just want to sketch the usual framework of quantum field theory on curved space time, which in this at least as I wrote it down here works only for globally hyperbolic space times. So.
But even much stronger, only those with global timelike Killing fields. Is otherwise,
no,
at least the only procedure to choose creation and annihilation operators I know.
No, this construction can be done without having a global time, I think, because it's just that there's no unique construction in this set.
Yeah.
So you can define Fock space and you can define creation and annihilation operators, but these will in generally only be unique when you have a global timeline.
That's essential.
Okay. So having this construction, it's important here that we have a physical Hamiltonian which generates dynamics and is non-vanishing. So this operator acting on the physical state is non-vanishing but generates true dynamics. And this is important in reading. So when the question is now, how can we get from here to there? Or is it possible if there's no unique way how to get from root quantum gravity to quantum field theory? Is it still possible to start with quantum field theory and then look if this can be embedded in loop quantum gravity somehow? And this is exactly the question which I want to try to answer here. So let me tell you what people have done before me concerning these issues already. And this is basically work. At least the one I am referring to is work of Thomas Thiemann and Hanno Sahlmann in 2002. So this would be point two of my outline, previous work, and what I'm citing here is Thiemann and Sahlmann, 2002. And what they did is basically they generalized this construction here to the case where G is not a classical metric but an operator in some sense. So what they did is basically take the Hamiltonian constraint from GR, and this Hamiltonian constraint has one part which is only a function of the gravitational fields, and the other part is the function of the matter fields and the gravitational fields. So this Hamiltonian constraint will be one part of the gravitational fields, and then a matter part which depends on the matter fields, their momenta, and the flux variables. Because at least for scalar fields and gauge fields, the coupling is only to the fluxes, but not to the holonomies. And what they did is they used this part of the Hamiltonian constraint to define dynamics and to construct a Fock space like this. So what they basically did is they used this thing and then wrote down a transformation from field operators phi and pi to creation and annihilation operators. Which are functions of phi, pi, and the flux operators now. So you see the difference here. The creation and annihilation operators are functions only of these two operators, but on the classical metric. And now here, these are functions of the flux operator. So these are operators on the Ashtiga-Lewandowski Hilbert space themselves. And one can also construct a Fock space for this setup, and this Fock space will be of the following form. So we have a vacuum state, which now is not a vacuum state anymore, but becomes a vacuum. You could call it a vacuum operator if you want so. And this vacuum operator, we call it 0e, is an operator, linear operator in the Ashtiga-Lewandowski Hilbert space. In the sense that how is this object actually defined? So one can go through construction. And what happens then is that this vacuum operator will be the zero operator when you act with a matter annihilation operator on it. So that condition is essentially that one. And second,
sorry.
Yes.
Is that a vacuum unique or
no? Yeah. It's not unique. It's not unique in any sense. Yeah.
So does a one-to-one correspondence between, say, the duplicity of vacuum flux in the conventional framework and in that one? So
that
does in principle in that framework you can have more than one vacuum for sure. The question is, how can I basically relate? Does this procedure increase the number of vacuum or not? That's the point. Because physically, that's very important, having more than one vacuum.
Yeah.
Because you have the Hawking radiation for the black hole, which portion of the you can define three vacuum.
Yeah.
These are connected to three different physical situations. Now the question is, on that side, what happens?
So here it's that each vacuum basically corresponds to a specific choice of observer, right? And here, at least in their work, they give a kind of a canonical construction how to arrive at exactly one choice for the vacuum, but there are really some ad hoc assumptions in there. So which are not based on physical grounds, I think. So I would say that I'm actually not sure about this question.
Okay, maybe.
Maybe we can try to find out.
Okay, cool.
So the essential second. So this was expected from that side already, that the matter annihilation operator should annihilate the vacuum. But this is still an operator in the Ashtiga-Lewandowski Hilbert space. So it should be interpreted in this sense. I think maybe this answers your question at least partially. If you take this as an operator in Ashtiga-Lewandowski Hilbert space and act with it on a coherent state, let's say peak on a classical metric E0, and then you just take the scalar product in the Ashtiga-Lewandowski Hilbert space, then you should get out this thing as a classical.
Okay.
So maybe
there should be
a correspondence, but yeah. I'm not sure if this is one to one or not.
Yeah. Okay.
At least this is a construction which they gave in their paper, and there are some points which are at least difficult, and which I want to talk about a bit today. And also right here.
Sure, you can write anywhere. You have actually another, you have two black, there are three blackboards on each thing.
Oh.
There's another one under. No, can I ask a general question?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
There's a previous long history of attempts to apply the Born-Oppenheimer approximation in quantum gravity. So going back to Bang, Starobinsky, and so forth. Is what you're talking about have any relation to that?
Yeah, I think the method is exactly the same, and there will be a relation. And so what I present here is basically a detailed analysis of the issue, especially in loop quantum gravity, because there will be one essential point which is very difficult to answer, and this is basically the thing that I don't really use the operators. And as far as I know, the Born-Oppenheimer approximation was so far mostly used in the Wheeler-DeWitt approach, where you, at least on a formal level, you can write down many things. So you can use the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and then you use it to see how classical physics emerged out of that. Mm-hmm. But I think at least the works which I'm aware of are mostly in the geometric dynamics approach. So
okay, let me just ask you a dumb question. How could the choice of annihilation creation operator just depend on the spatial metric? I mean, for example, you know, Friedman Robinson Walker has spatially flat slices, as does Minkowski space time, as does De Sitter space time, but they have very different properties with respect to quantum fields constructed on them.
Yeah.
So if the vacuum is only defined knowing the spatial part of the metric,
yeah,
how are you going to recover the difference between Friedman Robinson Walker, De Sitter, Minkowski space, etc.?
So I think the construction that they did in their work is basically what they do is they only use the spatial metric basically on the spatial slices and set left and shift to zero and so work effectively in ultra static space times. So I think they do not explicitly write it, but I think this is effectively what they do. And so in order to do everything properly, so when you look at this, what I wrote here, I mean, here you have the full metric in there, and when you look at the book from Wall, for instance, quantum field theory and quantum statements, then what he does there is you basically look at the classical theory, construct the space of solutions of the classical theory. Like by looking at the symplectic structure on this space, you can somehow construct a Hilbert space. And this is exactly the Hilbert space, which leads to a certain choice of vacuum. And by following this construction, you see that there is a unique choice of vacuum for if you have a global timeline filling vector field and not if you don't have one. And I think when we follow this procedure, I think as long as you only treat the matter sector, this is cheating a bit because in a sense you do not take you do not take into account what happens if you go from that spatial slide to another one. But if you take the gravitational part as well into account, which will at least in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which will happen in the second step, then I think you are regaining all the information.
Let's see how. Okay. And then, so we mean zero here. You mean a specific four-dimensional metric.
This is a specific...
which is not going to be consistent with the gravity dynamics.
Not three-dimensional.
Yeah,
yes, well, Yeah, but the states are labeled not by three-dimensional metric, but by four-dimensional metric. So
yeah.
In order to define the state, you need to specify four-dimensional metric.
Okay, but what I was saying here is just if you use coherent states, so these things are coherent states, and these are just coherent states which are peaked on a classical, on a three metric, basically, on and on the extrinsic yeah. curvature as well.
So which four? Yeah, when you write zero, zero, you mean the Fock state is labeled by four-dimensional metric, so you have in mind a specific four-dimensional metric. The complete right-hand side. Yes, here. The Fock state should be labeled by four-dimensional
yeah.
metric. So you have in mind the one which is completely static?
I think this is the one which is really static in this case. But I do not agree that this that this derivation is fully correct. I think it's just that this is what they did, and as far as I can interpret it, they arrived at states which are peaked on a metric which is E0 or let's say a three metric on a spatial slide, and then static with respect to the fourth direction. I think this is really what comes out.
Okay.
That's somehow workable. In the sense that, so is it formal, or you can somehow imply to that corrections?
No, this is it's really formal. Doesn't. I think you cannot compute anything. Yeah.
So, but if it's static, and if you have a coherent state that's peaked on B and P,
yeah,
then you would expect that there is a classical solution labeled by E and P because it's an initial value. For GR. And that may not necessarily be static.
No, it's just this, at least in the way I wrote down the state here, it doesn't know about B.
Yes. Let it go ahead.
Yeah.
This. You're, not responsible. You're not responsible for what they did. So.
Okay. Apart from the problems which you realized already, there's some more problems which I want to tell you about now. And these problems are, so first, I think that there is no true Hamiltonian. It's lacking. And this is basically, what they did is they used part of the Hamiltonian constraint to define dynamics in the metro sector. And I think as long as one is only interested in quantum fields, quantum field theory on a curvature background, there's no problem at all, because there one can just say, okay, this is a Hamiltonian, and then one can analyze it. But in a fully background independent theory, the Hamiltonian constraint vanishes, and so one needs to have some justification why it is okay to work with that. The second issue, which is important, is I think that I told you how they define the vacuum, and they can also, in the same way, just define n particle states by letting the creation operator acting on the vacuum a couple of times. And the problem is, how do these states work beyond the classical limit? In a sense, What they checked is that if you sandwich these between two coherent states and then compute the inner product, then you get this. And already here there might be some issues, but beyond the classical limit, it is not really clear how this was an answer to the question maybe, but how can you use this formalism to compute corrections to metadynamics on a given background? And as long as this works only for the expectation values, it is not really clear how one should do it. And the third thing is maybe there is this built-in non-commutativity in the flux algebra, and how can you get from here to a classical metric, which is a commutative object on the, or maybe to a three metric cube on the three-dimensional slices. And what I want to tell you today about is concerning the first issue. I think that using methods from reduce space-based quantization. And the choice of certain material reference frames, one can make progress in understanding the first issue. And so concerning the second issue, I want this is basically what the second issue is, basically what I try to address with Thomas and Sina in the article, which is about to be published now. And so what I wanted to talk about here is that we should have a closer look at semi-classical tools, which are usually used for just the issue of how do we get from a quantum theory to a classical theory, and then analyze which one might be appropriate. And here, the method of choice would be the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. And concerning the third issue, I will not tell you anything today about, but I recently took together with Alcide Baratin and Daniel Orici and Bianca Dietrich, we started looking at this issue a bit from a different point of view. So we started to look at if it might be possible to find a representation where we can represent the fluxes as multiplication operators with a certain non-commutative star product. And the idea would be if you can maybe expand this non-commutative star product in such a way that you have these operators as ordinary multiplication operators plus certain correction terms. And this might be useful for to understand the issue, how can you get something commutative out of that one. But I think I'm not going to tell you about this today. So maybe let me start with the first point concerning the reduced phase-based quantization and material reference frames. And there, the issue which one needs to address is basically when let's say
there should be another one up there.
Yeah.
That's what the hockey stick is for.
The issue basically is the following. So when we look at material reference frames and reduced phase-based quantization, and the question is, if we look at the system gravity plus matter, because it's a background independent system, in the sense that we do not have any preferred background metric, it turns out that if we write down the Einstein-Hilbert action plus some matter action, that, as I told you already, there's a Hamiltonian constraint in this Hamiltonian, or not a Hamiltonian constraint, but a canonical Hamiltonian, which is the sum of constraints, and this Hamiltonian vanishes. So there's basically two ways one can follow when one tries to quantize such a theory. The first one is just what is known under the name Dirac program. And in the Dirac program, what one does there is, so we first quantize all degrees of freedom which are present in the system, no matter if they are gauge degrees of freedom or not gauge degrees of freedom. So then you quantize all degrees of freedom. And then in the second step, so we need to get rid of the redundant degrees of freedom because it's just too many. So there's gauge degrees of freedom in there, and we need to get rid of the gauge degrees of freedom. And so how is this done? We need to solve this equation basically and now impose this as an operator equation acting on the states. And these are physical states. This equation should be zero. Then the third question is, if the Hamiltonian does not generate dynamics, but it's just h degrees of freedom, what is dynamics? And this question is very hard to answer. So in background-independent theories, in background-independent quantum theories, not much known is about dynamics questions so far. on the other side, what one can do is reduce phase-based quantization. Reduce phase-based quantization. And here, one goes the other way around. As a first step, one solves the constraint. On the classical level already. And this leads to a number of Dirac observables. Dirac observables in such a theory are all the objects which commute with all the constraints. One with ON, so this is just a number of Dirac observables. And then one can look at, because the phase space is a symplectic manifold, so it has a Poisson bracket and a structure. And here one can compute the Poisson bracket between different observables in order to know the relation between these ones. And this, in general, is a very complicated object. So the Poisson bracket between these observables is very complicated. And then, as a second step in such a loose space-based quantization, one would try to find a representation of this algebra of observables. So one first computes the observables on a classical level, and then just looks for a representation of this algebra. So one only quantizes the physical degrees of freedom, but not the redundant ones. But as I told you, this in general is a very complicated object, so the second step is really complicated, usually just because you cannot find representations of such an object. But if you manage to find representations, then this is really good, because at the, as a third step, now we come back to the question of dynamics again. And this question is much easier to answer in this framework, because dynamics here is just how does one observable, O1, evolve with respect to a second observable? And it turns out that for that this can be written as the Poisson bracket with a certain object, which is more physical and Hamiltonian. So that is for, if you choose an observable O2 as a clock, so this should be the observable which measures time, then you can construct an object physical Hamiltonian, which just generates this evolution in this sense. So here, the main difficulty in the reduced phase space quantization is that this algebra in general is very complicated, so that we might be stuck here at point two because we do not find representations of this algebra. So for general relativity alone, this is surely the point, the case, because if one computes the Dirac observables for general relativity, first this cannot be done explicitly in most cases, but for the ones where it can be done, it's unimpossibly complicated and one is stuck. But how can one proceed? So in principle, one can look at a slightly larger system than general relativity. So that means just couple additional meta fields to general relativity.
But in general, there's no strict equivalence between them.
No, these two are not known to be equivalent.
Well, no, they are known.
No.
In finite dimensional case, there are lots of theory and problem for that correspondence. So what's known is that the two quantizations are isomorphic. So there is explicit isomorphism between the two, but this isomorphism is not a unitary isomorphism.
Okay.
But you know, this is the whole theory of quantization commuting with reduction, which is very well studied. And in the context of spin network, it has been, you know, that's part of this new way.
I think this holds, that does is also hold for if the constraints are not formally algebra. Yes, I think not.
So it's always kind of true locally. So it's only proven as mathematical theorem in the case of free algebra.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, so you expect formally these things that we get the same type of input space and dimension, etc., and you get some kind of isomorphism, but it's not a unitary isomorphism.
Okay.
Even in the case of the algebra, you know, the isomorphism is not unitary. You need to rescale the scalar product.
Yeah.
So you don't get the right scalar product.
Yeah. So of course one expects that these two strategies should give similar results, although it's not proven as far as I know for non-linear algebras, and for the Jaffa algebra it's more complicated. But
for the example of the Gauss law, for instance, on spin network, mm-hmm. this has been fully proven.
Yeah. Okay. So my point was just in principle, one has these two rules which one can follow, and so one can either first get rid of the redundancy field of freedom and then quantize, or the other way around. Mm-hmm. And both might have advantages and disadvantages. And here the disadvantage is that one does not have a clear interpretation of what is dynamics. Because once one solves this equation and computes all the physical states, then one is left with observing, but you do not know what is dynamics. And here, the difficulty is basically that for this algebra, it's very hard to find representations, because in general this might be a very difficult algebra. And for this difficult algebra, if you manage to find representations, then the question of dynamics is straightforward.
But we mean H physical. An observable is something that commutes with H physical.
No, H physical is not. It's not a constraint.
So what do you call H physical?
So here I just define H physical by this equation.
So what is the left hand side? D over D O two.
That is the how does observable one change along the lines of observable number two.
And where is observable number two there?
Oh, this is just random observables.
You could call it HO2. It's kind of like an evolution operator.
So this is
defined
this is,
by
yeah.
with respect
so
to.
So this is of course not a unique thing. So depending on so
dynamic use my HO2 any operator H.
So the question is what is dynamics? Dynamics is how does one quantity change with respect to another quantity?
So do you mean just the commutator of O2 with O1?
Here, no.
What is H?
It's a very complicated object which can in general not be given explicitly. But
which is a function of
all the observables.
And how do we choose it?
Here I don't choose it.
Should we discuss this so much here? But because we also want to get to what yeah. actually had in the results. So.
Yeah. So I can give explicit examples for what this actually is, because I wanted to say that in general this algebra is rather complicated, but one can choose to work with a bigger phase space, not general relativity, but general relativity plus measure plus certain plus x basically. So Einstein-Hilbert action plus the matter action plus the action for whatever you want to use as a reference frame. And actually so theories of this kind have been analyzed quite a lot in the past, in the sense of I think that Tevez would fall into this category, or Einstein ether, or even Morava Lipschitz, if you want to put it in such a way. And what I want to talk about here is that as this X, one can choose certain dust fields, which were first used by Braun and Pukas in 1994, and when one just uses these dust fields, couples them to general relativity, and then looks what comes out, then one can basically do the following. So take four scalar fields, call them T and Sj. And I will not give you the explicit action, but if you're interested in, we can discuss it later on. And these fields can be interpreted just as pressureless dust fields propagating on the four-dimensional manifold, and then basically use the framework of relational observables, Carlo Rovelli and other people, and compute the relational observables within the reference frame where you use these as plot variables. So in the dust frame, and the dust frame I want to just define by the readings of so tau is by tau I define the reading of the fields T, and sigma j the meaning of the field as J. So J runs from 1 to 3. So if one computes these observers in the dust frame, then it turns out that they have quite remarkable properties. So for instance, when one has a 3-metric QAB, and then looks what is actually the observer associated to the 3-metric in the reference frame given by these dust fields, then if I just note this by capital QAB, then it turns out that the Poisson algebra by the observables QAB and PAB, where PAB is just an observable corresponding to the canonical ADM momentum, this is just the usual delta, so CD and then all the indices. So basically the important thing is that that when basically going from the kinematical algebra, from QAB to PAB to the observable algebra, nothing changes. So the computing the observables in this sense is a Poisson automorphism. And this is basically the essential point why the dust fields are useful if you want to compute anything. So because you have a very simple algebra of observables, and so for this algebra you can find representations. I mean it's just a standard representation. And this can be done. Furthermore, one can give a physical Hamiltonian. Coming back to your question, so what is exactly the quantity that defines dynamics, the physical Hamiltonian? And if you choose the dust fields T and Sj, then the quantity that generates evolution with respect to T is just the square root of C squared, I just tell you what that is, QAB, CACB. So the generator of equations of motion is just given by this square root, and where C is a gravitational plus matter contribution from the Hamiltonian constraint, and CACB is just a gravitational matter contribution from the Diffie-Wolf constraint. And if you write down the equations of motion generated by this physical Hamiltonian, then you get how the quantities QAB and TAB evolve with respect to T. So this is one example. Here, this can be written in a closed form, but in general, it's rather complicated to read what you exactly mean. And these dust fields are especially nice because you have this algebra of observers, so it looks like you get an easy algebra. But we have checked this, for instance, in one argument for the spherically symmetric case, and there everything works, and also the check for correspondent. Okay, so what I want to do is basically I told you that this question one, so we're looking for a true Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian is still lacking, and
Yeah, well, so, I mean, this was known in the 1960s, and Karl Kukács criticized it very strongly because it's not positive definite. And the criticism was made already then that you can't realize that as a positive definite operator on Hilbert space.
But he didn't do it by himself in 94, I think. So it would surprise me if he criticized it in the 60s.
Well, is there in fact a way to deal with the minus sign and the square root and construct
that? Because it turns out that the dust fields you have to couple that they have negative energy if you treat them as separate vector fields. So in this sense, is it what you mean?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's the answer. But anyway,
this by definition is positive.
Why is that by definition positive?
Because it has the square root.
But that by which you're saying what you mean is the square root of the absolute value of what's inside it.
Basically, what is under the square root is constrained to be positive. So
constrained, you mean?
Well,
I think this is what they'll demand. This is an assumption that this, what is under the scalar that has to be positive, right?
Yeah. It's you define it like that, and
but it's not guaranteed that it's positive.
Yeah, that's not guaranteed.
Of course, I agree that, especially defining the square root as an operator, is a difficult thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is all reminiscent of why you have to. What, you know, going back to the early difficulties in the 20s with Kluge's prime theory and trying to define the square root, including the Kluge's prime theory with an arbitrary potential. I forget. But anyway, go ahead.
It's just a question about these restrictions. What type of restriction that it implies on the initial data? The fact that you have this quantity to be positive.
So again, C is the
C is the gravitational and matter contribution of the Hamiltonian constraint.
Summed up, so it's C gravity plus C matter.
Yeah.
But not C dust.
No, not C dust. Right. Otherwise it's going to vanish, right?
Right. And C B is the same for the diffeomorphism.
Yeah.
So it's a restriction on your sets of initial data. What does it mean physically?
I'm not exactly sure.
Okay,
go ahead. Okay. So the point what I wanted to make is that in principle when you follow the Dirac quantization procedure, then it's not justified why you should use the Hamiltonian constraint as a generator of physical dynamics. And you have to find some extra arguments why this can be done. And if you take this physical Hamiltonian, then what you can do is maybe you can expand it. You can just expand the square root in something like 1/2 QAB just in the second term, plus higher orders. And you can promote this into an operator. So you can kind of define an operator like out of this sum. And there you would see that in the first sum, the first term is just the Hamiltonian constraint. So what does it actually mean? This quantization, I didn't show you exactly why, this reduction of the phase space actually means that you're going into a preferred reference frame which follows geodesics of the dust, and this can be interpreted as a reference frame of a free-falling observer. So this is the Hamiltonian forming gravity and matter, a free-falling observer, and for this free-falling observer, at least under the assumption that these terms are small, which is only fulfilled for certain types of space-time, such as Minkowski or Riggle or Smogger, then you would get that the Hamiltonian constraint is really the leading term in some approximation. But if you choose other matter, so let's say you perform a reduced phase quantization using other matter fields, then it gets more complicated, and in principle, there's no argument why you should see the Hamiltonian constraint as the first term in an approximation or something else. But at least this is what I wanted to say. So one can use these methods in order to try to find what is a true physical Hamiltonian that generates equation of motion. And this will be a Hamiltonian which depends on the observer, at least if you follow the reduced phase-based strategy. Okay, so let me now come to the second point, what I wanted to tell you. And this is basically the Born-Oppenheimer approximation and how this can be useful for understanding how to get from this quantum system to the classical one. And there, the big question is, having a system, a quantum system A, and the quantum system B, and this quantum system A has a number of degrees of freedom, capital Q, capital P, small q, small p, and the Hilbert space, which is the tensor product of one Hilbert space for the one variable set of variables, the other one, and has a Hamiltonian. Let's just for simplicity assume that it's just a standard Hamiltonian plus a potential depending on both. And here you have a system where we have quantum degrees of freedom p and a small q and small p, and classical degrees of freedom q and capital Q and capital P. So the Hilbert space in this context is just the one of the small variables, and we have a Hamiltonian, which is given by p squared over 2m plus the potential, which now depends on an external parameter and a quantum variable. So something like this. And the big question is, how can we get from there to there? And in general, the answer is nobody knows how to get from there to there. At least if you want to derive, if you start from such a system and you want to derive that such a regime exists in the theory, then it's very difficult to actually do that because you have to face all issues like incoherence and this stuff. But if you already know that such a system B exists, in which you can treat one half of the variables as classical variables, then it makes sense to basically reconstruct how this can be embedded in the other one. And this is exactly what different kind of types of approximations do. So, for instance, the WKD approximation or Oppenheimer approximation using coherent states or anything like that. And the method which I wanted to use was the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, but I don't have that much time, so I'll be really, really short on that one. And so basically, the Born-Oppenheimer approximation is just the method to go from here to here, basically using that the fact that such a system exists, showing how you can embed it in this one and how you can compute corrections to the big one, knowing that. That you know the dynamics of the small one. So basically, first you need to look at the dynamics of the small system B, and it turns out when we solve the Schrödinger equation for this system, and just assume that that you can write actually down, actually solve the eigenvalue problem. That's the Hamiltonian operator depending on the parameter Q minus an eigenvalue depending on the parameter Q. And this whole thing acting on functions depending on the parameter Q would be zero. So, and then the question is, and I think I call them chi, and the question is, can you use these functions? So you know that there exists a solution for system B, and the question is, can you use these solutions to obtain knowledge about the solution of the big system? And this can actually be done when you make the following ansatz. And this ansatz is just, so we want to write down solutions for the whole quantum system A, which should depend on Q, and we just use these solutions Q, assume that they have certain, let's say, certain quantum numbers I, something, and then just put some coefficients in front, which depend on the other variables, on the capital Q. So assume that with this ansatz we go into the, we start into this problem, knowing that these exist already. And so how can we see further now? The question is now we know the chi's already, but how can we determine these variables? And this can actually be done.
What do you call HBQ?
J I just want to know. Because it's a Hamiltonian for the system, which only has these small derivatives, but
no, H sub Q, okay.
It depends parametrically on this external parameter. So what, and this is actually an essential point, because here you have an external variable Q, and in order to be able to use this ansatz for solving this equation, you do not only need to know these functions for each Q separately, but you also need to know how they behave if you go from one Q to another. So you need to know how do they change if you change if you follow a path in parameter space Q, basically. And this using this ansatz, which is known as the Born-Oppenheimer ansatz, you can go into the solution of this problem and then try to just solve it. And it turns out that in order to compute these coefficients, you get a certain equation, which is a matrix value operator. It's a lambda also depending on the on Q. On the size is just an eigenvalue. So if I just want to solve this equation, h psi alpha equals lambda alpha psi. I just the ordinary Schrodinger equation, trying to solve it, leads to such an equation where the this operator Cik is basically just given by the action of P squared, capital P squared over 2m, acting on the eigenfunctions of this system. And here, the scalar product is just about the small variables. So, in principle, now, if everything would go through, so you start with the system B, to know that these solutions exist, and then you use your knowledge from this system to compute solutions to the big system. And here, it turns out that you have this operator, capital C, IK, and the true Born-Oppenheimer approximation, or what is known as the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, is then a certain approximation, which basically says that this operator, that you just take this operator to be diagonal, and neglect the action of the feet on these wave functions. So you just say that the derivative with respect to the capital variables does not affect the eigenfunctions. Of course, this is a very crude approximation because, in general, you neglect a whole lot of information. And also, you say that this thing is diagonal. But, so, using this approximation, I just want to write down an equation which is known as a
Born-Oppenheimer. But it's like. This is a number Cik.
Cik, this is an operator.
So our number is equal to 1. Okay. So our number could be equal to an operator.
Number?
Cik is a number.
No.
Cik is.
Cik is
an operator acting only on the.
Okay, so the important thing is here, Cik is basically, you have this operator, capital P, which are derivatives by the capital Qs.
I'm confused about your big P and your small P, I guess. So,
the essential point is.
Is it the small P or the big P?
This is a capital one. Okay, let me just briefly. Here you have functions, eigenfunctions for each capital Q separately. This is clear, right? And if you want to use this in in the solution of the big problem, then you need to know how do these functions change if I go from one Q to another. So the operator P acting on these functions is not zero. Because this is how does how do these functions change when I go from one kernel view to another kernel view? And the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which was used by Born-Oppenheimer, is basically neglecting this information as a first step. So you basically say, okay, these functions are eigenfunctions of this operator, and this and this is diagonal. So this is basically what you're saying. But okay, so let me maybe just. If we want to write out a solution of this quantum system, and then we have an equation which basically looks like p squared over 2m. So this is the part from here plus lambda I, which also depends on capital Q, and this thing acting on the coefficients and then we wanted to solve the eigenvalue so this is the equation due to Born-Oppenheimer and maybe let me just say a few words how one should interpret this. So the interpretation is we solve part of the problem already, so we have the eigenfunctions chi, and now the only thing remaining is we need in this ANDAS to solve for the coefficients. And this can be done using this equation. And it turns out that when you're interested in the dynamics of the capital variables, in the quantum dynamics of the capital variables, that as a first step, to take into account the presence of the small variables is basically introducing these, taking the eigenvalues of the small variables. So this basically means effectively taking into account the presence of the other variables. Q. So now it's an essential point in the derivation of this whole semi-classical framework, Born-Oppenheimer, as well as when you look at other approximations, then it turns out that it's basically the same there. And it's basically the step that when we look at this equation, which defines dynamics in the sector for the small variables, that here it is essential that we can treat the variable Q, capital Q, as an external parameter. External parameter means this is a classical variable, and we need to be able to look at the question, how do these eigenfunctions change when we go from one capital Q to another one? And this is an essential assumption in order to make this whole approximation scheme work. And so here we basically see that if we treat this sector quantum and the other classically, so then this works only if two assumptions are fulfilled. And one is that we basically have two separated energy scales. This has to do with the fact that we can treat one set of variables as semi-classically speaking, slow ones and the other one as fast one. But what is even more important is that this approximation makes only sense if capital Q is a multiplication operator. Because otherwise, I mean, even when you treat this as a multiplication operator and you switch on quantum dynamics in the capital Q sector, then it gets complicated to demand differentiability of path of the capital Q or something when you look at this equation. Because in path integral measure would not be basically the non-differentiable path would dominate the measure, but as long as this is a multiplication operator, it turns out that this approximation at least makes sense in a certain regime, and this has been tested a lot in the context of molecule physics and so on. So what was basically the main point of my talk was, which I wanted to tell you, but now I didn't have time, is that in loop quantum gravity, we are in a very complicated situation, because in loop quantum gravity, what we would do is we would basically consider as a system B just the quantum field theory on a fixed background spacetime, and as a system A, just full quantum gravity. And we know that system B exists, so we know that quantum field theory on a curved background spacetime makes sense. And for quantum gravity, we do not we have formulations of quantum gravity, but we do not know whether they are phenomenologically viable or not. But what we should do now is try to embed quantum field theory on a curved background into full quantum gravity, and by all classical methods which are available, from which I showed you now the von Oppenheimer approximation, it is turned out to be essential that Q is a multiplication operator, not a derivative operator. And in loop quantum gravity, so the system B would be quantum field theory on a curved spacetime, and we would try to embed this into full loop quantum gravity. So we would have phi and pi as quantum variables, and the system A, which we want to investigate, would be let's say loop quantum gravity or another formulation of quantum gravity, and here we would treat phi and pi as well as the fluxes and the holonomies as quantum variables, and here we treat the fluxes as classical variables and the holonomies as classical variables. So it turns out that this is very difficult in loop quantum gravity, and one somehow needs to think about how is it possible to embed quantum field theory on a curved spacetime into loop quantum gravity or into quantum gravity, because this has to be done, because we know that quantum field theory on a curved spacetime makes sense, and so there must be a way to embed it somehow in quantum gravity if the quantum theory on gravity makes sense. And so there's basically two routes which one can follow, which I only want to briefly state now. One route is what I was trying to tell you before, that one can actually try to develop or to find a representation of the kinematical algebra of loop quantum gravity, where the fluxes act as multiplication operators. And as I indicated already, one would try to expand the star product of these flux variables around just the ordinary multiplication in order to find the sector where this makes actually sense. And the second thing, which we have done in the article with Thomas and Tina, which I wanted to present in detail, but I think I don't have time for that anymore, is one can try to find a new representation for quantum gravity, not starting with the holonomy flux algebra, but just starting with something else. And what we have tried to do is we constructed a representation which is much closer to the usual Wiener de Witt representation than to the quantum gravity, in the sense that we just use a co-triad as a configuration variable, and one can just base the quantum theory on that one, and one can formulate a framework which is very similar to algebraic quantum gravity, and using that one can basically use all the approximation schemes, and then in the end try to find something as one can understand how quantum field theory on a fixed background spacetime can be embedded into such a framework, and the big open question is then how can one understand true particle scattering in the sense of particles propagating on a fixed background and interacting with each other? How can one understand this in this fashion? So I went really over time now, so I think I don't have much time. So, but I would be happy if some of you would want to discuss things with me later on.
Is there any, say, possibility of doing that with some brutal approximation? I don't know, just to grasp the possibility of building alpha A. So, have you already done that, or are you going to do that?
It's basically what, no, so what I was saying, basically that the problem is with these operators, because they do not commute, one has two possibilities. One of the possibilities we have done already, that is we constructed a new representation for quantum gravity, which is not based on the holonomy flux algebra and stuff, but which is which is in a sense not so nice, because I would consider it more as a toy model because it doesn't have such a nice geometrical interpretation and so on. But it can be done. You can write down this equation for the case of for the case of quantum gravity plus matter, and there we can at least see how quantum field theory on a curved space-time, at least in a certain lattice approximation, is embedded into a full theory of quantum gravity, and where the main point of constructing this whole thing was that we can use that we can represent the geometrical operators as multiplication operators. But you're still left with a really complicated equation, because in the end you get something like Hamiltonian constraint of gravity plus extra corrections, and this is the operator where you would want to solve the spectral problem basically. So analytically, this can for sure not be done, and but I think in principle one would have a choice to look at this problem from a numerical side, just because it's very similar to what people do in let's say in lattice quantum field theory. So I think
in that case we have also a transition regime, so some parameter or something that lets you switch from a B to A and so on.
Yeah. So I did not look at a numerical analysis, and I think I'm probably not the right guy to do that, but it should be possible because it's close to lattice gravity.
So, where I thought you were going with the whole talk is that the holonomy operator, or more generally the connection operator, is a multiplication operator. And therefore one can make progress, and I thought you were going to do that.
Okay. The holonomy operator is a multiplication operator, that's right. But the problem is that for all the meta fields we have, they only couple to the fluxes. At least for scalar fields and for gauge fields. They do not, because the fluxes, they encode the geometry of the three surfaces. Do you know what I mean?
No. I know what you mean. But it is nonetheless possible if you want to make a brute force. If you want, and maybe we can say this for discussion. If you just want to make a brute force approach,
mm-hmm.
and start with something like you went through the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. Something's backwards to the textbook way. The textbook way is to start with a state which is a Hamilton-Jacobi state, or and take that as your ansatz times the matter,
yep.
Or the fluctuating variables, and you can certainly make progress representing or extracting Schrodinger equation from the DeWitt equation, basically following what Tom Banks did a long time ago,
yep.
And what Stravinsky and so forth did.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we can save that for discussion. Maybe that you don't want to do that because that doesn't fit into the Ashtekar-Lewandowski measure picture.
No, I think in principle,
they would have the same problem as we would have here, in the sense that that when you look at the when you honestly look at the Born-Oppenheimer approximation and analyze it very carefully, and then you see that in the Wheeler-DeWitt approach, it works somehow because there you have the metric as a multiplication operator and not a derivative operator.
Well, I don't think so, but I you don't can think, say this for
okay.
discussion.
Okay, then, yeah.
No, last question.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that on the last slide, or the last part of the textbook, you mentioned that you would that the embedding would be done somehow in the lattice. That you would that the system be QFD on the curves.
Yeah.
Space time. Then the curved space time would be approximated by a lattice,
yeah,
and then embedded.
Yeah.
That I know that from the philosophy from which we the, for example, the master constraint program was derived,
mm-hmm,
this lattice is backward independent. But I have the gut feeling that it introduces a background.
Yeah.
A physical, so, that you could measure physically. And that you generate a whole landscape,
mm-hmm,
for each lattice that you can invent to generate a new possible quantum field theory.
I'm not really sure about this point, but I can tell you what the strategy is that you followed. So basically, using the co-triad and other variables as a basic variables, and then we just smear them in a diffeomorphism invariant way. So I mean you can smear the co-triad along one-dimensional edges, and then you get at least something diffeomorphism invariant. Not so for the it's not gauge invariant. So in this sense, but it's diffeomorphism invariant, and then you have a classical lattice theory. And then at least the philosophy behind that is basically, okay, let's just use the algebra which I get on the lattice and just find representations of that one. And I find representations for this algebra on an abstract algebraic graph, which is not embedded in anything. But and you can find representation, you can use a certain infinite tensor product in the Hilbert space to actually find representations of that algebra. And then you have a theory which is not a geometrical theory and which doesn't have anything to do with general relativity, in the sense that it's only defined on abstract graph. And it tells you how certain quantities which are labeled by positions on the graph evolve in time, if you want so. And then what is the link between this abstract algebraic framework and general relativity? And the links comes, I must say, for not for every state, which is part of the theory, you have a classical interpretation. Not for every state, you don't even have a geometrical interpretation for most of the states. But you have a certain class of coherent states, which we also constructed in the article. And these coherent states know about the embedding. So you basically put the embedding from the theory in the coherent states, and I, by myself, I'm not exactly sure if this is the right way to do or not, because it might be cheating a bit or it might be not. I don't know. I mean, if you want to have a theory of gravity in the end, at some point you need to have an embedding. I mean, otherwise you don't have geometrical quantities. If you're just working on a graph or on simplicial complexes or whatever, at some point you need an embedding. And in our case, we just put the embedding in the coherent states for the classical sector. But I must say that I'm not sure if this is the right thing to do or not.
Okay, it's already 20 plus hours, so let's finish here. Thanks to you.